You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. The American Legislative Exchange Council, the brainchild of Paul Weyrich, who so famously said back in 1980, he actually had started it in 1973, some suspect in response to the infamous memo that Lewis Powell wrote to Eugene Sidnor, his next-door neighbor and president of the Chamber of Commerce, about how it was important for business interests to start taking over everything from schools to, well, frankly, to our government. That was 71. 73, Paul Weyrich and his buddies started the American Legislative Exchange Council. Here's Paul Weyrich, by the way, back in 1980 when he was helping run the Ronald Reagan campaign.
Now, many of our Christians have what I call the goo-goo syndrome, good government. They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down.
So that guy and his organization, he's passed away in the intervening years, but his organization has done nothing but get stronger and bigger with a little help from the Koch brothers and others. And the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC, is having their 40th anniversary this week in Chicago. And Brendan Fisher, the general counsel, the attorney for the Center for Media and Democracy, PRWatch.org, which runs ALEC Watch, ALECWatch.org, is on the line with us. Brendan, welcome.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you here with us. We covered this briefly yesterday on this program, but I think it's worth updating because it's still going on. What's first of all, a recap. What's going on in Chicago?
Sure. So this is ALEC's annual meeting. It's the biggest ALEC meeting of the year. Bring state legislators together with corporations to schmooze, have corporate-sponsored parties, get taken out to dinner. And during the day, they adopt model legislation that tends to benefit the corporate interests that are bankrolling ALEC, and in large part deciding what sort of legislative priorities there are going to be for the next year. Today, actually, legislators started their day with what we call a climate change denier breakfast. It was a breakfast where they heard from Joe Bastardi, who's a meteorologist who thinks he knows a lot about climate change and that it's false, and James Taylor of the Heartland Institute. And the Heartland Institute is a right-wing think tank that made headlines last year for billboards comparing people who believe in climate change, who acknowledge climate change science, comparing those individuals to mass murderers like the Unabomber. Legislators went on to hear sessions about how certain ALEC members passed right-to-work and Medicaid reforms in their state, and it was a workshop sponsored by the State Policy Network, which is a network of right-wing, state-based think tanks that gets its money from the Mysterious Donors Trust, which is a sort of a money laundering system for the Koch brothers and other big interests. And that's what was happening inside. But outside, I think ALEC was treated to some of the biggest protests it's ever seen. There were well over 1,000 people, possibly more than that, a broad coalition of labor groups, a number of labor unions, civil rights groups, gun safety groups, and other people who just care about democracy, who care about politicians acting on behalf of the people they represent rather than acting on behalf of corporate interests, raising their voices against ALEC and, you know, asking ALEC to get out of Chicago and to really get out of our policymaking in America.
So here we have lobbyists and executives from America's largest, wealthiest, and most powerful corporations, and particularly the ones, the dirtiest ones, shall we say, the tobacco industry, the oil industry, the coal industry, that kind of thing. And they are there, and they obviously have a legislative agenda, and they pay, what is it, $40,000?
It varies. So the membership itself, there's different tiered levels between $7,000 and $25,000, plus you pay additional fees to be on the task forces. The task forces are where you actually propose and vote on model legislation, and then you pay additional fees to sponsor ALEC meetings, to sponsor workshops. Like there was a workshop on how great it is to have coal exports, or how great fracking is, or how great virtual education is. This particular meeting, those sponsoring those workshops came with a price tag of $100,000. There's all sorts of little extras that you can.
Right. So a company can spend hundreds of thousands of dollars to be there, to be able to write the legislation. And then the Republican state legislators, this is not U.S. House of Representatives. This is state by state, all 50 states, representatives, by and large, virtually all Republicans, my understanding. I know that there's one Democrat there. She snuck in. She's going to be on our TV show tonight. But by and large, it's all Republicans. And how do they get there? A lot of these state legislators, they don't make a lot of money. This is at the Palmer House, one of the fanciest hotels arguably in the entire United States.
Yeah, it's a beautiful hotel. I think I said last night on your program, it's a beautiful place to create some really ugly legislation. Many of the legislators who are attending this, they work part-time. The average legislator salary, state legislator salary, is $40,000 a year. So for many of these state legislators, they would not be able to afford a trip to Chicago and three nights in the Palmer House on their own. But luckily, they have some help, and that help is coming from the same corporate interests that are proposing model legislation that want to see ALEC bills introduced in their state. ALEC calls this a scholarship. What we call it is probably, I think it sounds less like a scholarship and a lot more like a bribe, especially because the preference for people receiving these scholarships and being appointed to the task forces, that preference goes to legislators who introduce ALEC model legislation. So if you introduce ALEC model bills, if you carry water for the ALEC corporate agenda, then you get paid back by fancy trips to nice hotels and fancy trips to places like Chicago or New Orleans. So it adds to the environment of undue, improper, excessive corporate and special interest influence.
Amazing. And Brendan, the corporations then, they bring to these ALEC meetings pre-written laws that they would like to see put into place that protect their corporate interests or increase their profits or make it harder and harder for people to know what they're up to or to challenge them. And these Republican legislators hear the sales pitch and then basically sit in a room and sign off on it. And my understanding is that it's like one-on-one, one legislator for every Republican representative in the room, and that it's majority vote. So, if all the legislators and one Republican says, yeah, let's do that, that becomes a piece of model legislation. Do I understand that right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And it's not that they're in these meetings hammering out legislative language or really collaborating. That actually gives more – that sort of depiction of how ALEC would work would give more credit to legislators than they're due. These bills usually come to ALEC fully formed, pre-drafted by corporations, designed to advance the corporate agenda and benefit the corporate bottom line. And then the legislators and politicians vote on whether to adopt it as an ALEC model bill. And the corporations and legislators are given an equal vote. They have equal membership in ALEC. They're considered equals.
Right.
And so, yeah, I mean, it's very much the corporations are driving.
It's like Mussolini's definition of fascism, the merger of corporate and state interests. I mean, this is mind-boggling. And this is how we got stand your ground, shoot first laws. This is how we got right to work for less laws in state after state. This is how we got the voter suppression ID laws, not to mention all of the things that make the oil barons like the Koch brothers rich. It's just incredible. Brendan Fisher, General Counsel for the Center for Media and Democracy, PRWatch.org, and of course, ALECWatch.org. And if you're in Chicago, you might want to check out what's going on down at the Palmer House or across the street from it. Brendan, thank you.
Okay, thanks a lot.
We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I think this may be the first year that Americans are really waking up to how badly corrupted our democracy has been by this organization over the last 40 years. 20 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, speaking the truth. The multinational corporations would really rather you didn't know. And actually, speaking of and to that point, Ekajian, if I'm pronouncing it right, put together just an absolutely brilliant blog yesterday. Yesterday morning, in fact, over at the Daily Kos. And making the point that, you know, Rince Priebus is going off on the liberal media. And, I think this is just absolutely fascinating. Agian says, if we had a liberal media in the United States, there are some things that would just be public knowledge, standard information. So, like, you know, everybody knows about, what, Whitewater? Or everybody knows about Anthony Weiner? It's, like, sad but true. Bob Filner. But if there was a liberal media, wouldn't there be like a certain baseline of information that everybody would know that, and these are like the really serious things that you would think people would know. Like, for example, 2000 was the last year in the United States that transnational corporations actually had positive hiring numbers in the United States. Now, it's real interesting. There's a Living Wage Now has a post over Democratic Underground where he talks about the NAFTA and how Bill Clinton is so blamed for NAFTA and largely takes the blame for it. He says, however, Bush's policies of giving major tax incentives to corporations to outsource is what really gave outsourcing its fangs. Following the Bush tax cuts of 2001, American manufacturing and our factories shut down and outsourced millions of jobs to China, India, etc. And there's a graphic here from the Wall Street Journal, of all places, that shows that starting in 2001, sure enough, transnational corporations, the big companies in America, in 2001, they moved or they created, shall we say, about 250,000 jobs outside the United States. In 2002, about 1 million jobs outside the United States. In 2003, about 2 million jobs outside the United States. 2004, a little less than 2 million. 2005, about 1.5 million. 2006, about 1.5 million. 2007, they created about 1.5 million jobs outside the United States. 2008, back up to 2 million. And in 2009, they created 3 million jobs outside the United States. Now, during that same period of time, they were moving jobs out of the United States. Actually, those numbers I just read you were all the numbers of the jobs that vanished in the United States from these corporations. They pretty much correlate, though, with the number of jobs that were created outside the United States by the same corporations. So it's just these two numbers just diverge. So number one, if we genuinely had a liberal media, everybody in America would know that for the last decade, the last 15 years, ever since the big Bush tax cuts, the transnational corporations, the job creators, have been creating jobs outside the United States, but they haven't created a single damn job inside the United States. In fact, they've shut down millions of them. Another thing that that everybody would know if we had a liberal media in the United States is that if you were to look at a map of the United States and break it down according to who owns what wealth, you would see that basically everything west of the Mississippi River is owned by the top 1%. Everything east of the Mississippi River and north of the Mason-Dixon line would be the top 9%. So basically the entire northern United States, and not just, I mean, this is actually below the Mason-Dixon line. About a third of America would own the southern states. 20% of the United States would own half of Texas. And 40% of us would own this little red dot. You know, it's about the size of Houston, I guess. In other words, the poor are really poor and own virtually nothing, and the rich are really rich and own pretty much everything. You'd know about the American Legislative Exchange Council if we actually had a liberal media in the United States. I guess I'm qualifying as that because we just told you about it. But, you know, the Stand Your Ground laws, the Stand Your Ground Shoot First laws, the voter suppression ID laws, the right to work for less laws, the privatizing schools laws, the health savings account bills, the tobacco industry supportive legislation, all these things. If we had a liberal media in the United States, you'd know about the number of people in prison. And there's a graph of this, and it's truly startling, from 1920 to 2006. From 1920 until the Reagan presidency, the number of people in prison in the United States is under 400,000, and it just kind of steadily moves along nice and slow. And then starting with the Reagan presidency until today, it just explodes. You go from 400,000 when Reagan became president to 1 million when Reagan left office, to 1.5 million by the middle of the Clinton presidency, to 2 million when George Bush came into office, to 2.5 million when George Bush left office. It's mind-boggling. If we really had a liberal media in the United States, you would know that 62% of people arrested in the United States, 69.2% of people arrested in the United States are white, but 39% of our prison population is black. Now, there's got to be something wrong with those numbers. You would also know that our high health care costs in the United States are the highest in the world, at $8,200 a person. Norway is second highest at $5,300 a person. You'd think we'd know. But most Americans don't. They don't know any of these things.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
When was the last time you heard the so-called liberal media talking about Glass-Steagall or gerrymandering or the number of bills blocked by Republicans in Congress? Welcome back to the True People's Media. Talk media for the rest of us, the Tom Hartman Program. By the way, I want to know your take, so if you have a comment or question for our radio show or TV show, grab your phone or turn on your computer, put your face in front of the camera, hit record, and send your videos to yourtakemytake@gmail.com. If you don't want to be seen on TV, then leave a message on our rant line at 202-536-5306, and tune into The Big Picture every Thursday night for our Your Take, My Take live segment. And, of course, we play them here on the radio show as well. So, liberal media? Very interesting. Oh, that's interesting. So Matt wants to argue with me about that. That should be fun. Hey, Matt, you want to talk about liberal media?
Yeah, I want to know why you think that it's not liberal. Well, actually, no, I don't know. I don't want to know.
It's not that I think it's not liberal. It's that I think it is heavily conservative, heavily conservatively skewed. Look at just the percentage of people who show up on Meet the Press as guests. Republicans, overwhelmingly. When it was during the Bush administration, they said, well, it's because Republicans are in control. We need to put more of them on. And then during the Obama administration, and even when the Republicans were not in control of the House, they said, well, we got to have more Republicans in because they're the opposition. Democrats are in control. I'm not making this up, by the way. You can go back and check it out.
Sure. Well, I guess I have more of a problem with what you were just saying as far as how you can tell that the liberal media or the media is not liberal.
What makes you think the media is liberal?
Well, I mean, I can cite an example from last night. I think that might have been more than last night, but Obama goes on Jay Leno and says that, hey, we're widening the Panama Canal, deepening it, widening it, so that these bigger ships can come in. And if we don't, he said that if we don't widen and deepen our ports in the Gulf, such as, and then he went, I don't know the exact ones, but he went to name a bunch of ports in the Atlantic.
Right.
And nobody called him on it. In fact, there was a liberal media site who, I think it was a newspaper, I'm not sure, you might want to look it up, but there was a newspaper article that talked about his quote as how smart he was in his foresight, and instead of railing him about mentioning these Atlantic ports and calling them Gulf ports, they inserted a word that he said like. So these the ports like, and then they went to mention.
Well, is the Gulf of Mexico not in the Atlantic Ocean?
Yeah, no, it is, but Like Jacksonville is not a Gulf port, which he mentioned as it being a Gulf port.
Oh, because it's on the Atlantic side of Florida rather than the Gulf side of Florida. Okay.
Yeah,
and you think that that's proof that we have a liberal media, that they didn't call him on that. I think, frankly, the fact that, you know, when he said that, and by the way, Jay Leno show is not the news media, but it's our entertainment media. But nonetheless, I think that, you know, when he said that, or if the news had covered it, if we had a liberal media, they would have said, you know, why do we want to increase our ports and thus the amount of stuff that we're importing into the United States from low-wage countries when we should be bringing our jobs home and manufacturing things here?
Yeah, that wouldn't happen.
Because we don't have a liberal media.
Jay Leno's not the media, which is another question as to why the first time he spoke about,
Jay Leno's had every president on as long as he's been doing that show. I mean, that's just a regular venue for presidents. George Bush used to go on
right there.
Both so George Bushes.
Remember how much everybody made fun of Sarah Palin when she said that, she could see Russia from her house?
Yeah, because it's a stupid thing to say.
The funny part about that is that she didn't even say it.
Okay.
It was Tina Fey as Sarah Palin who said it.
Okay.
But no, this is the thing is that.
But I don't recall any news.
This is the real reason I called. Is that your assertion that all of the things that you mentioned that people would know if the media was liberal?
Yeah.
The arrest rate, the incarceration rate, that stuff. That your assumption is flawed because you're assuming that people actually watch the media. People don't care. They don't watch.
I think they would. I think that you know Americans would. And let me give you another example. This one hit me this morning. I was reading this article in the New York Times, and actually I was reading it on my phone, so I don't know where it is in the actual physical New York Times, but it's on their front page of their electronic section. And it said, started right out, first paragraph, Governor Rick Scott down in Florida is trying to purge his voter rolls of people who are not citizens. And he's not. He's trying to purge his voting rolls of people he says are not citizens. And the first time he tried this, he said there were about 180,000 people who were not citizens and these were all people who had Hispanic surnames. When they started looking seriously, or the vast majority of them, when they started looking seriously at these numbers, they whittled it down to 2,000 people. Then they contacted them and they whittled it down to 200 people. And ultimately they found 40 people who were on the voter rolls who, by the way, none of whom had voted, who were not citizens. So you've got 40 people in the entire state of Florida. That's not going to turn an election. And those people are all now eligible to go to prison. So now he says he's going to do it again. What gets buried in these stories, and it's always buried in the last couple of paragraphs, is that the way that he's going to do this is he's going to send a postcard to everybody in Florida who has a Hispanic surname that says, if you don't show up at this address at this time within the next X number of weeks with proof that you're a citizen, if you don't take off work and come down here and show us, then we're going to automatically remove you from the voting rolls. Now, this is called caging. The Republican Party has done this for years. They've been operating under a restraining order since the 1980s, since Paul Weyrich was advocating this stuff during the Reagan administration. Since the Reagan administration, they've been operating under a restraining order preventing them from doing it. You'll find no mention of that in these articles. You'll find only a brief mention of the fact that he's sending out the postcards.
I thought you just mentioned an article that you read this in.
Yeah, this morning's New York Times.
Your point that,
I saw several of them yesterday in other media.
That's the media covering that. How about Barack Obama saying that the Keystone Pipeline would create only 50 permanent jobs, and that's all that it would do for the economy?
That's true.
And, you know, it was a blurb on Fox News. Nobody even cares about it.
It was true.
Permanent jobs, and that's it.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, that's true. You're right. And, the fact that we're paying $4 a gallon for gas now has nothing to do with the economic woes and, you know, bringing more oil.
You do realize, Matt, that according to TransCanada, the company that's building the pipeline, this is not Greenpeace. This is the company that's building the pipeline. In an official press statement, they are saying that if the Keystone Pipeline construction is completed, it will probably raise the cost of gasoline in the United States by 10 to 20 cents a gallon, and it will certainly raise the cost of gasoline in the Midwest, because right now the Keystone Pipeline terminates in the Midwest, and they use it to refine gasoline, which they sell in the Midwest. When they get it down to the Florida or to the Gulf Coast, to the Texas coast, they're going to export all of that gasoline. In fact, they say right on their website, TransCanada will tell you who they're going to export it to. It's going to China, it's going to Brazil, it's going to England, it's going to Mexico. They already have the customers lined up. None of that gasoline is going to the United States. The people who own the factory, the plant down there that's going to refine it, one of the biggest ones, is the Koch brothers, who are funding all these right-wing Republicans. This is a scam, Matt. Look it up.
All right, that's great. I mean, that's not what I called about.
But my point is, if we had a liberal media in America, everybody would know that. The president finally had to acknowledge it, as you pointed out.
Everybody wouldn't know that because
I think so media, because this is just another corporation trying to suck our country dry.
The media is a business. Not enough people care about that to put it on TV, and that's why it doesn't get on TV.
No, that's they do not poll topics before they cover them.
And skew it. They take every issue and skew it left and give Barack all of the...
I agree with you, Matt, that the media is a business.
How about the gay marriage thing?
I agree with you that media is a business. Hang on just a second. I agree with you that media is a business, and that's the reason why we're getting infotainment instead of news. And up until 1987, we had a way of dealing with that. We had a rule that the FCC had made back in the 1920s that said, if you want to use the commons, if you want to use the airwaves of our nation, the electromagnetic spectrum that is the property of we the people, of all of us, if you want to use that with a radio or television station, you have to operate, you have to program in the public interest. And what that meant was, the way that was interpreted, was that you had to actually provide news programming at the top of every hour, or for radio and for television, you had to provide a news block, a half-hour, hour-long news block in the evening. And it had to be actual news, not spin, not infotainment, nothing about dancing dogs. In 87, Reagan did away with that. And the next year, the news divisions of the big three networks, which all used to be independent, and they used to be huge. They had bureaus all over the world because this is what their stations needed to keep their licenses. Those news bureaus all came under the entertainment vice presidents of each of the three networks, and they still are to this day. And that's why we have infotainment, because Reagan deregulated the media, essentially. And I think it was a disaster.
Yeah, but, I mean, constitutionally, he should have done what he did.
No, there was nothing in the Constitution about that. There's nothing in the Constitution that says if you want a license to own a television station, you get it, whether you program in the public interest or not. We're talking about the business end of it here, Matt, what you brought up. I mean, if you want to publish a newspaper and go out and not drop it on people's doors or hang it, you know, from the local telephone pole, then you might have an argument. But I'm talking about using the public airwaves. Matt, thank you for the call. Thanks for listening to WCPT.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Makes one want to say, I love the smell of napalm in the morning. You know, it's always nice to have an argument with somebody to start the show. Helping you win the water cooler wars, Tom Hartman here with you. And Lee in Chicago. Hey, Lee, you wanted to talk about John Lewis's comment about Snowden?
Yes.
Did you know that he's walked that back?
Pardon?
Did you know that he's walked that back today?
Did he really?
Well, sort of. The way it was reported yesterday by The Guardian was that John Lewis praised Snowden, saying that you know, Gandhi was willing to take the hits for what he believed in. Martin Luther King was willing to take the hits, you know, go to jail for what he believed in, ultimately to die. And that Edward Snowden apparently was willing to take the hits for what he believed in. And
he's called it civil disobedience.
Well, no, he put it in that frame, but he didn't explicitly say that Edward Snowden was engaged in civil disobedience. And today he has come out and said, I was not praising Edward Snowden. I would not praise him. I'm paraphrasing, but I just read it like an hour ago, so it's pretty fresh in my mind. He said he has harmed the national security of the United States and might have even put people's lives at risk. He said, however, what I was saying was that Gandhi and King were willing to take their punishment in exchange for what they for doing what they believed in. And it looks to me like Edward Snowden may be willing to take his punishment for what he believes in. Now, you know, running to another country is not quite taking your punishment, but, you know, he did lose everything in his life. And so I guess you could call that take your punishment. But,
yeah.
You know,
yeah. Well, so did Dr. King when he gave the speech at the cathedral.
Yeah.
And we're coming up, I believe, on the anniversary of that. 90% of the black community turned their back on Dr. King on that. And so, I mean, I know that it was a very bold statement for him to even start to get on with, you know, speaking about Snowden on such things as civil disobedience.
Yeah.
And,
but John Lewis, actually, he asked for a retraction from The Guardian, and they provided one.
Wow. That's a shame.
Yeah, it's over on Democratic Underground right now if you want to read about it. So, but did you want to, you wanted to comment on it? Do you want to add something to that?
No, I just wanted to pass it on. I had read it and I had not seen it on any of the U.S. papers or anything.
Yeah.
And, you know, I just wanted to bring it to light. I had not read that it had been retracted, and I'd called his office twice today, so I'm really surprised.
Yeah, I'm guessing he got a lot of blowback. It probably made its way over to the Blaze or something, or the Drudge Report, and you know, he started getting the death threats. I can tell you what it's like. You know, I was on the Blaze last weekend myself, and you get on Glenn Beck's website, and all of a sudden you get the white supremacists coming after you. But Lee, anyhow, thanks for the call, and we'll see how this all plays out. Khalib in New York City. Hey, Khalib, what's up?
Hey, man, how you doing, Tom?
Good. What's on your mind?
I wanted to address a couple of issues, but I want to do it as fast as possible. I see you guys running out of time. I think
pick one if you can, sure, please.
Okay. I want to share some information or make some statements about the banking system in America and how no politician or public servant is addressing the banking system and its inevitable collapse because nothing has been done to change it since we had the collapse in 2007.
Yeah.
And furthermore, there's no one addressing the issue of paying off the debt to the central bank or the IMF to work a way off to pay off the debt so we can restore America to its true sovereignty.
Well, there's two issues here, Khalib. The banking system, you're absolutely right. It's screwed up. It hasn't been fixed. It's crazy that our country has to borrow money at interest from a private bank when we could be printing our own currency. We don't run the printing presses. The Fed does. On the other hand, the second thing that you brought up is our national debt. Our national debt is a problem, but it's not a huge problem or even a serious problem, and it's not at all a problem compared to our national trade deficit. That's the thing that's hollowing out the United States, the fact that every year we buy anywhere from $500 billion to $1.5 trillion more stuff than we sell to the rest of the world, and as a result, the rest of the world is coming in and they're buying up big chunks of the United States. They're buying our infrastructure. They're buying our mines. They're buying they're buying our land. They are taking the wealth of America because, you know, it's the same. It's just like, you know, the game that Rick Snyder is playing in Michigan with Detroit. Oh, yeah, let's auction off the art gallery to my fat cat friends. I was talking to one of my brother Stan today, who lives in Michigan. And he was like, yeah, it looks to me like, you know, that's what's going on. Rick Snyder wants to hand this stuff off to his rich buddies. And that is what's going on. But it's happening on a national level with this so-called free trade. But what's the specific problem you have with our banking system?
The specific problem I have is we don't have a standard anymore. We just have paper. We have paper that's issued to us by an outside entity that controls our interest rates and our interest rates on our homes, our automobiles, our student loans.
Right.
They control all the interest rates. They control whether or not we pay or not. Okay, Bernanke, we're going to drop, you know, the interest rate by half a percent or whatever. Come on, dude. No average American can understand that in layman terms. They don't understand what that
You know means. Why we went off the gold them. Standard, Khalib?
It doesn't even affect them. It doesn't even affect the average American.
Yeah, no, I got that. You know why we went off the gold standard? Because when you're on the gold standard, you can't have more dollars in circulation than you have gold in Fort Knox, basically. And if you can't get more gold, your economy can't grow. Or you have to radically revalue your dollar, which puts you into a crisis mode with every other nation in the world. And that's what was going on right up until the 1970s, I guess. 1971 was when Nixon took us off the gold standard. what was going on was that we were only taking payment from foreign countries in gold, and we ended up with this huge stockpile of gold, and it's like, what value is this? What good is this doing? I frankly think it's better that we have a fiat currency. I am convinced if we went on the gold standard, it would be the destruction of our economy really, really fast.
I don't think so.
How does an economy grow without adding gold? And why should we have to add gold to grow our economy?
Look at what they're doing in Saudi Arabia, and look at what Gaddafi was trying to do in Libya.
Saudi Arabia is not on a gold standard. They simply make gold coins. The riyad is not on a gold standard.
They have a natural resource to bag their money. They have a natural resource, which is oil.
So do we. We've got our entire country that backs our money. All of our natural resources, everything. You know, our country is worth about $56 trillion. That's what backs our money. Khalib, thank you for the call. We'll have to have this conversation to continue at another time. But I strongly suggest that you type into a search engine both modern monetary theory and gold standard and see what pops up. It's coming up on the top of the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and Mike Papantonio, the attorney and host of the Ring of Fire radio and TV program. RingofFireRadio.com is the website, is online with me. Hey, Pap, how you doing today?
Tom, how are you doing?
Very good, thank you.
Good.
I hope the same is true of you.
Everything's good.
So you're on a tear about BP. What burr got under your saddle here?
Well, it's not just me. What you're having is the victims are tired of being called frauds. It's not about lawyers. It's about the victims who actually lost everything they have in some situation. Tom, this is one of those pigs at the trough stories that we're seeing coming out of the oil industry almost every week now.
Wow.
BP killed 11 oil rig workers in the Gulf of Mexico in an effort to make quick money. You know that story. Their Deepwater Horizon oil rig, 11 people died. Right before that, they killed 15 workers and severely injured 160 in one of their Texas refineries from conduct that was so egregious that they had to plead to felonies. Add to that, because of all that BP death and carnage simply to make quick money, we started learning the story behind the story, and here it is. We learned that between 2007 and 2010, 97% of all the oil industry OSHA health and safety and death violations, 97% of them came from BP.
Wait a minute, 97% nationwide?
Nationwide. 97% of every time there was a violation that involved death and destruction, it came from BP.
Came from one
British-based
company.
Right. BP, Tom, this is what is infuriating the victims in the Gulf states right now. This is not a lawyer story. This is the victims that are so angry about this. BP has a criminal history that makes the Cosa Nostra look like choir boys. Illegal price fixing is at least a couple times, probably more. Illegal dumping of toxins, manslaughter, perjury, lying to Congress, environmental criminality, Tom, that's too extensive even to cover on a TV or radio segment like this. It's not just in America. It's all over the globe. So now we learn that their image as criminals has become so bad that in the Horizon case, that they've spent, just in the Horizon case, $600 million on Madison Avenue PR to build what they refer to as their good guy image. Mm-hmm. When you've killed more people than John Wayne Gacy and you had to plead guilty to that slaughter, it's tough to make that image stick. So here's the story. What BP's new approach is to attack their critics right now their angriest, most vocal critics are the victims in the Gulf states who've seen their environment destroyed. They've seen their businesses and income decimated. They've seen their physical and health damaged. We don't even know how severe it is. Every day we're hearing a new story of a health problem. Their fisheries here in the Gulf states, their life, sea life has been mutated for a generation. And this company, with that kind of corrupt criminal history, is now in a full attack of the claimants. Mm-hmm. And the story, Tom, it's they're actually appearing in front of court. As you probably know, full disclosure, we're one of the firms that are handling the case against BP. Understand, they signed. They had their 1,000-plus lawyers review an agreement with the victims. And the agreement was, you make your claim. If you fall under these criteria, we will pay your claim. They went out to their stockholders to avoid an uprising with their shareholders, and they told their shareholders it was only going to cost about $8 billion. They were told point blank in court, time and time again, no, it's going to cost closer to $50 billion. But so what they've done is they've lied to their shareholders. I don't know who's going to handle the case that comes out of that, but they've lied to their shareholders in order to keep their stock up. They now have to attack the victims so they don't have to pay out as much money. Look, you know I handle the biggest cases in America against some of the most corrupt industries, all the way from tobacco to the pharmaceutical industries. I have never seen this level of corruption that we're seeing out of BP.
Wow. And you know, you say full disclosure, you're a litigant or a participant in this. I would say, therefore, you know what the hell's going on.
Oh, I'm right in the middle of it. What we're really in the middle of now is this is what they've done, Tom. They now are trying to, with this criminal history, illegal price fixing, illegal dumping of toxins, manslaughter, perjury, on and on. With this kind of history, they are actually calling the people making claims frauds, which is it's insane. I mean, there's no way that a fraud claim is ever paid by this facility. But this is the story they want to tell. And what they're doing is they're buying full page ads, basically calling people frauds if they make a claim, trying to get people discouraged from bringing claims because they're so concerned that they lied to their shareholders to try to keep their stock up, to try to keep their shares up. They out and out lied when they were told point blank, this is going to cost probably in the neighborhood of $50, maybe even $60 billion. Do not tell your shareholders that this is only going to cost $7 or $8 billion. So now the lawyers who lied about it that worked for BP, the accountants who lied about it that worked for BP, they say we're in big trouble now because we've signed this agreement. We had our thousands of lawyers review the agreement. They said sign off on it. We signed off on it, and now we're trying to backpedal and get out of it.
The agreement being that they would compensate people for their
damages.
Oh, yeah,
and Tom, they're very specific. They say this is what we'll compensate and this is what we won't. The people making the claims are falling right within that compensation route. There's nothing untoward about anything.
Tell me about these ads. What do they say? I can't imagine what an ad would say that would cause me, you know, if I was harmed, I live on a boat in the river here in D.C. If somebody dumped a whole pile of oil into the river and it damaged my boat and I was thinking of laying a claim against them, I can't imagine what would be in a newspaper ad that would cause me to not do that.
There's kind of a funny edge to this. They put out a call-in fraud number, an 800 number call-in fraud, and what they were horrified to find is all the people were calling in was the fraud that BP was committing in the overall majority of the calls apparently have to do with people who are victims who are calling BP saying, we thought you wanted us to tell more about the BP frauds that they're committing down here on the Gulf Coast. So they're getting more calls about their own fraud than any fraud really taking place.
So what they're doing basically is the same thing that the Republicans are doing down in Florida. And Texas
voting.
And the southern states,
yep.
Where they're saying, with voting, where they're saying, oh my God, we got this horrible problem with voter fraud.
Right.
When really what they want to do is turn the voters into the victims. They want to get them off the voting rolls.
Very good analogy. I never really thought about it, but you're right, right on. The idea is if you create hysteria around fraud, then what it does is think about this. We have people that are in their terrible health.
Mm-hmm.
They've lost their businesses, some of two or three generation in the fishery business and the restaurant business and businesses all along these Gulf states. They've lost, for all practical purposes, they've lost their financial, some of them lost their homes, they've had to pull their kids out of college, they've lost their automobiles, and it's all directly related to the crime that was committed down here on the Gulf Coast, where they've destroyed an entire ecosystem. Tom, you have right now a story just occurred, a story just showed up where the sperm whales in the Gulf are the most polluted sperm whales in the world. And that has a direct relationship to what BP did here in the Gulf of Mexico. We have mutations of dolphins, mutations of fish. We have the most bizarre stories of sea life mutations that you have ever heard. It even rivals what we saw with the Exxon spill. But nevertheless, they feel they have so much money they can turn this on the victims.
Amazing. Absolutely amazing. Boy, I'd love to get into, you know, the politics of there's so many dimensions to this. We're going to have to talk about this again, Pep.
It's a big story.
It is. And, you know, I'm curious how this is affecting the political perspective of those people, you know, the corporate-owned politicians. Yeah. Anyhow, Mike Papantonio, ringoffireradio.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And, Pep, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
We'll be right back. For the rest of us, the Tom Hartman Program. Pap was just talking about BP. And I'm going to get into this in some greater detail in the next hour with relationship to Walmart and McDonald's and paying living wages and those kinds of things. But isn't there a fundamental question we should be asking ourselves? I mean, when you've got a company that's responsible for 97% of all the occupational safety and health claims in the country, when you've got a company that has killed dozens of people, when you've got a company that has wounded hundreds of people, when you've got a company that has destroyed the lives of tens or hundreds of thousands of people and billions of dollars of ecosystem, when you've got a company that has pled guilty to felonies that if you had committed them, you'd be in jail for the rest of your life, including murder, or at least negligent homicide. When you've got a company that has done all those things, I think at some point, and this is again why I say we don't have a liberal media in the United States. In fact, the media is all dominated by ads from BP talking about how wonderful they are instead of conversations like this because they want to keep the ad dollars flowing. But when you've got a company like this and Americans seriously start finding out what's going on, isn't it reasonable that they would start asking questions like, shouldn't some of these executives be in prison? I mean, BP threw over the rails two of their fairly low-level flunkies down in the Gulf for not paying attention to some kind of safety warning. They said, okay, you guys can go to jail. Maybe. We'll see. I think that trial is still ongoing. I don't know the details of it. But, you know, what about Tony, what was it, Hayward was his name? Sounds like a movie star. Yeah, what about that guy? He's back in the UK. You know, are the executives still flying around in their private jets? Do they still have multiple homes all over the world? Do they still have, you know, the gold-plated faucets on their sinks in the corporate suites? Do they still have butlers and maids? Do they still have valets? Do they still have an army of personal assistants following them around? Do they still travel to work in a helicopter? I mean, the answer to all of these things is most likely yes. Is that the way we treat criminals in the world now, in the United States now? Well, if you're looking at banksters and you're looking at oil companies, if they've got enough money to buy politicians, to buy the political system, they can also buy the criminal justice system. And particularly in those places where you have elected judges, they're making sure that their people are getting in these seats. Then, yeah, that's what's going on. And isn't it time to put a stop to it? I mean, back in the 1880s and 1890s, you had people rising up against the robber barons, against the Andrew Carnegies and the John Rockefellers and the people who owned the big mines, the Ludlow mine. You had all these kind of things going on across the United States, labor actions. And what came out of that, out of those labor actions, were that what in today's dollars would be the billionaires of the time, you know, the robber barons of the time, they hired private armies to kill people. I mean, in Ludlow, Colorado, you had striking workers occupying a mine area in tents with their wives and children. And the company that owned the mine sent a wagon through there with a Gatling gun on the back of it, and just these people were protected by canvas. They were in a tent. Families killed all kinds of people. And finally, after 30 years of this, and of small businesses being squashed like, but now we've been seeing 30 years of it ever since Reagan unleashed these people. And I've seen small businesses being squashed like bugs by giant trusts and out-of-control oil companies and steel companies and banks, J.P. Morgan and his buddy, all this stuff. Finally, in 1901, when President McKinley, a rather conservative, business-friendly Republican, was assassinated, his vice president became president. His vice president, a young fellow by the name of Teddy Roosevelt, who had come from a wealthy New York family, had fought at the Battle of San Juan Hill, as I recall, in the Spanish-American War. Decorated war hero. Everybody figured, hey, he's going to be another, you know, right-wing conservative toady for the corporations. But Teddy Roosevelt had so much money, he didn't need the damn corporations. You know, when they came to him, the way that they were coming to Supreme Court justices and saying, here, we'll give you a pass to go anywhere on the railroad you want, anytime you want, anywhere in the United States for the rest of your life, if you'll just vote our way. And this is how they were bribing back in 1886. This is how they were, one of the ways that they were bribing Stephen Jay Field on the U.S. Supreme Court. Sort of like, you know, the right-wing think tanks here in the United States saying to the wife of Clarence Thomas, you know, yeah, we'll pay you $600,000-$800,000. Aren't we nice? By the way, sure would be a good thing if your husband voted our way. Well, you don't even have to say that. So anyhow, the Americans got fed up with this, and Teddy Roosevelt said, enough already. We're going to start breaking these companies up. And then in the election of 1908, when he did not win re-election, another Republican, William Howard Taft, became president, and Taft continued breaking them up. It was what the people wanted. This trust busting. It was Taft, ultimately, who broke up Standard Oil. Roosevelt got the process started. I think we're on the edge of this. And I think that we would be way past the edge if we had even a neutral media in the United States. But this is a huge story that Pat's talking about, and it is not being covered by CBS, NBC, ABC, because they've taken millions of advertising dollars from the same company.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And because, of course, they have no more public obligation, because Reagan blew up the Fairness Doctrine in 1987. So they can do whatever they damn well please. It's the place where smart people get their news, the Tom Hartman Program, your media support group for we, the people of the United States of America. Let's get through some of these calls as quickly as we can. Tim in West Palm Beach, Florida. Hey, Tim, you want to talk about militarizing police in America? Tim? No Tim? Okay, let's try Ethan in Parrish, Texas. Ethan, can you hear me?
Oh, yeah, hey.
Hey, okay. The disconnection between the left and the working class? Go for it.
All right. Well, okay.
my dad is like one of those Ayn Rand people, I guess.
Oh, sorry to hear that.
They always, and they always talk about how like the Gilded Age is like the best time to live in America.
Well, it was if you were rich.
Well, yeah, right. I disagree with that. And, you know, what brought us out of that was, like, Teddy Roosevelt and the progressives, like you were talking earlier.
Yep.
And I think the problem that we have now is that with our politicians, at least, the left is the right. When I mean, by, like, they're both advocates of big business and everything, you know?
I don't see people like Bernie Sanders and Jan Schakowsky and Sherrod Brown advocating for big business.
Well, I mean, you know, I mean, they're all corrupt, you know.
No, they're not. Most of them are corrupt, but not all of them. There are still some good politicians out there, and there are certainly a lot of good people out there, maybe you, Ethan, who should be running for political office and should be taking over our political parties and cleaning them up.
I'm only 17, so
okay.
I got a little bit longer before I can do that.
All right. But, you know, think about it. Think about it seriously.
In high school,
mm-hmm.
I agree with you on the free college thing. I think that'd be great.
Yeah. Well, and you know, I was debating that last night with a conservative on TV, and she said, well, you know, it's not free. Somebody's got to pay for it. And I'm like, yeah, it's old people who are paying for it. And we were once students, and so it's kind of like paying it forward. You know, it's like, we are paying for the intellectual infrastructure that's going to support and build this country as we get older. And that's a good thing. And, then, you know, I don't see why that makes any – you know, why that doesn't make sense. It's, you know, why there's any problem with that. And in fact, we had free education in the United States from roughly the beginning of the 1940s after World War, well, the middle of the 1940s after World War II with the GI Bill, you know, right up through the Reagan presidency, or at least the Reagan governorship of California. Reagan started deconstructing the free public education in California. We had free public education in a lot of other states, too. And it was, in most other states, it was so cheap that it was functionally free. So, and that is gone. So, I'm with you, Ethan. Very, very well said. Thank you for the call. Charles in Chippewa Falls, Wisconsin. Hey, Charles, what's up? Charles? Charles, if you can hear me, I can't hear you. Try calling us right back, okay? Jay in Oswego, Illinois. Can you hear me, Jay?
Hey, I'm here with you. Can you hear me?
Yes, indeed. You're on the air, sir.
Fantastic. You know, I've talked to you a few times, Tom, and call me anti-New World Order, Jay. You and I talked about RFID chips. We even talked, just to kind of preface my commentary, I can't help but jump into BP for a second. You and I, maybe a couple of years ago, I brought you the setup for the wars there, Azerbaijan, the pipelines, the Caspian Pipeline Consortium,
mm-hmm.
the Bush-Blair connection that led to BP.
Yeah, the Tappy stuff.
And what's interesting to me is, I heard Pop on the air there, Pap Antonio, talking about his case, but it runs much deeper. The government plays a role. The government's involved. That's why these guys get away with it. They help them set up. They help them merge foreign domestic mergers. Elliot Spitzer didn't even look their way. He went after Martha Stewart. So we have to look at the facts, and the facts tell us that our government's up to their neck in this, and we might as well have them all merge and call them corporate.
So we have to ask the question, then, how did that come about? And the simple answer to that is that the Supreme Court decided that corporations are people and money is free speech. So let's fix that.
How do we fix, I guess, the
you amend the Constitution.
Overwhelming. How do we fix it from within when everyone's been compromised? Even though, yes, Bernie Sanders, those guys are out there, but they're treading water. I mean, they fit in a niche. They're trying to do what they can, but they're overpowered by the status quo. So you're right. They are oligarchs, and our democracy's paper. It's all but gone. So without insurrection, how do we change it? I guess that's the rhetorical here.
The constitutional amendment that's proposed by movetoamend.org would say corporations are not people. It would eliminate all of the protections that they have under the Bill of Rights. They can no longer claim privacy rights. They can no longer claim equal protection rights. They can no longer claim free speech rights. You know, all those things. It would do away with that. And it says money is not free speech, which would mean that, you know, the Koch brothers or Karl Rove or any other millionaire or billionaire who wants to come in, Dick Armey, anybody else who wants to come in and just pour a ton of money into a political campaign can no longer do so if Congress passes a law saying they can't do it. The fact of the matter is, Jay, you're right. Many of our politicians, in fact, I'd say probably most of the politicians in America, certainly the entire Republican Party and a not insignificant fraction of the Democratic Party, are basically sold out to various corporate interests. They don't like it, though. I can tell you, living here in Washington, D.C., and interacting with these people, most of them don't like it. Some of them love living the high life and getting the free trips all around the world and hanging out with the CEOs and stuff. But the vast majority of them hate the fact that they literally have to spend 3, 4, 5, in some cases 6 hours every single day on the phone dialing for dollars in order every single day of the week, in order to make sure that they have enough money that they can run for re-election. And even then, they live in fear that they may cross some billionaire, some cranky billionaire, who has the ability to take down any politician in America. And, you know, any one Wall Street billionaire could take down any one politician in America if they set their mind to it. And so these guys, if there was a serious groundswell of public support for the move to amendment to the Constitution, and already over 500 communities have voiced their approval and over a dozen states have passed, yes, let's do this. And we got an amendment to the United States Constitution that said money is not speech, corporations are not people. Then Congress, Republicans and Democrats, could say, okay, that's it. We now have the legal power. The Supreme Court is not restraining us anymore. We now have the legal power to throw off our masters, because many of them feel like they are in a master-slave relationship, or at least a nasty employer, you know, crappy job employee relationship, and or maybe an abusive spouse relationship. And I guarantee you, that there are probably half the Republican Party and certainly the vast majority of the Democratic Party would aggressively support that kind of legislation. And you would see that kind of change happen in America. And we have seen changes like this happen in the United States in the past, and because of citizen involvement. Probably the biggest are things like the Civil Rights era and in the 1920s, women getting the right to vote, which, again, was promoted by progressives because they thought that women had progressive values, and by and large, most women do. So this is how you do it, Jay, and this is what we need to do. This is the work of our lifetimes. Brian in DeKalb. Hey, Brian, what's up?
How you doing?
Good.
Yeah, I always listen to you all the time, and Progressive 780 pretty much constantly, even at work driving the truck. I just wanted to bring up the situation. You hear everybody, it's gone now, and I really would like to ask you to be a watchdog on the Fukushima Daiichi situation that you don't ever hear anything about. I mean,
yeah, we had Kevin Camps on the show. Was it Monday or was it last Friday? It was this Monday? Oh, it was last week. We had him on last week about this, from beyondnuclear.org. You're right. The Fukushima plant is a disaster right now. They're dumping millions of tons of radioactive water. into the ocean every day. It's now getting into the ground level. The levels have spiked. The Japanese Nuclear Regulatory Agency has come right out and said in front of God and everybody, this is an emergency, and they don't know what to do about it, and TEPCO is lying about it. And in the midst of this, we're building two new nuclear reactors in the United States, which just shows how insane we are. And again, it wouldn't happen if these nuclear power companies had not been able to buy the politicians in Georgia. So, Brian, I'm with you. Thank you. Chris in Corvallis, Oregon. Hey, Chris, what's up?
Hi. Well, I listen to your show, and I love it. Usually within 5 minutes of listening, I get upset and then really, really angry and activated. And what I see is that all these things line up, the economy, the environment, the wealth care system, the degradation of values and lack of opportunities and despondency among youth, all these things are connected. And I would like to encourage people, the vast majority of people, to get an attitude that we own this place, that the government is...
Yeah, I am totally with you, Chris, and you said it very well. I'm sorry to cut you off, but I want to get Lori on the air. We just have a minute to the break. She's at or was at the ALEC rally in Chicago, listening to WCPT. Lori, we got about 45 seconds. It's all yours.
Okay, Tom, beautiful day in Chicago, a wonderful, well-attended rally. Reverend Jesse Jackson was there along with Father Flager walking among the crowd. I would say at least 5,000 strong,
wow,
full and everything. And, you know, and when I was there, you know, the police were even applauding the speakers. But unfortunately, I got home and got on the web and heard, you know, that they were arresting people about an hour ago, and that got a little ugly. But it was such a well-attended rally, and I couldn't believe the number of senior citizens there.
Yeah.
It was so.
Is this going to happen again tomorrow, Lori?
No. Today was the big one, but they've been having, you know, protests yesterday, today, and today. Today was the permit one organized. Tomorrow, you know, people have been getting arrested, but.
Yeah. But Alec is still meeting tomorrow, right, at the Palmer House?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Lori, thank you very much for the heads up. And alecexposed.org, of course, is the website of the group that has been doing so much to raise all our awareness about it. I appreciate it, Lori. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
It is great getting live reports from the scene. Thank you again, Lori. We'll be right back. John Harbin here with you, and Ellen Ratner on the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com, or you can give a crystal heart made by women recovering from the effects of war in South Sudan at GoatsForTheOldGoat.com. Ellen, what's going on in the world today?
Okay, well, this is really interesting. The whole issue with Russia, and of course the president canceling that one-on-one with that Vladimir Putin, came up again at the White House briefing, and this has to do with the gay issues that Russia has been very, very tough on this. I think I may have said to you when I spoke to you, but maybe I didn't. I'm getting to have not so great a memory here. I'm going to a conference in Russia on the 8th, and two of our people have been turned down for visas. So that's a concern of a lot of people.
Two gay activists have been turned down for visas?
No, these are two people who were just medical people who had a military background.
Whoa.
So that's a concern from the White House and from obviously us. But Russia at this point said that they are disappointed at this being canceled. And I have to tell you, Tom, how do you not talk to somebody that you even disagree with? I remember interviewing Shimon Peres and he said, you know, in his Israeli voice, you have to talk to your enemies. Well, how is it that we aren't talking to them? It's just beyond me.
I think there is a very, very good piece in today's New York Times about how Obama is taking all this flack for closing all these embassies in the Middle East like he's some scared, you know, person. And I mean, the right wing characterizations tend to be far more sexist and far more biting or cutting. And of course, he's doing this because he doesn't want another Benghazi. And so on the one hand, if he doesn't close the embassies, he might get a Benghazi, which they will rip him to shreds for. And on the other hand, if he does close the embassy, they rip him to shreds for being a wimp. And I just want to say, stop listening to them. Stop, you know, President Obama, stop listening to Fox. Stop paying attention to these Republicans. You'll never be able to please them. Do what's best for the country. And the same thing with regard to his policies on Russia. I think he's saying no to Putin in part in response to, you know, right-wing talk radio and right-wingers in Congress.
I agree with you. And I think normally you say, hey, I don't agree with you on this, and that. But we're two big countries with nukes.
Yeah. Yeah. The two big countries with nukes.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Well, speaking of gay issues, the Pentagon today issued some new guidelines that they are working on. They want to give somebody 10 days to get married in a state that accepts gay marriage. They will have health insurance. They will have housing. I always say to Charlene, she left the military too early. But in any case, so it's looking up for gay soldiers. Fannie Mae, very interesting. Today they announced $10.2 billion in profits. They were bailed out in 2008, if you recall, and they now said that they're going to give $0.1 billion. I mean, they're going to give a $10.1 billion back, or are going to keep $0.1 billion for operational costs.
Wow. So how much do they still have to pay back in order to pay back the entire
bill? I haven't seen their full payment back. It was certainly more than the $10 billion in profits that they were bailed out. Now, back to things such as NSA. Jay Carney said that things are examined by a small portion, that they are only look at things as a small portion of what they collect. But, you know, let's assume you and I are talking about what we are going to talk about on the air, on email, which we often do, and we mention the name of one of these terrorists. Mm. Well, they're just going to go into our emails and look at all this.
Yep, then all of a sudden it's ding, ding, ding. And here's the weirder part. I was thinking about this morning, Ellen. I was thinking, you know, what if I wrote an email and sent it to Ellen with the name of every terrorist that I can find in the media? And, you know, and some little snarky message to whoever ends up reading it, you know, the Ed Snowden who's not leaving Booz Allen Hamilton. And then it occurred to me how stupid this is, because the terrorists know that we're doing this. They don't refer to themselves as, hey, Omar, hey, Ahmed. They probably call themselves Ralph and Bob.
Absolutely. And, I mean, I think you're absolutely right. I don't know what happened with this embassy terrorism. All I can tell you is they didn't do such a good job on the Boston bombings.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, and
plus, I still want to know what happened to that relative of theirs who got killed by the FBI down in Florida. I mean, that's the weirdest thing.
Right. And nobody's talking about it.
Yeah.
Okay. This is also very interesting. The Saudi government is now giving $100 million to the United Nations. They're going to start an anti-terrorism institute where 22 countries can get together and talk about their terrorism procedures and what they've learned, et cetera. Hmm. Now, a lot of people at the UN, the sort of scuttlebutt on this, is that the Saudis are doing this except for the fact a lot of people feel that they have not shared as much information, and they're doing this as sort of a $100 million smokescreen so that they can say they're doing something. I don't know the answer to that, but I think it's pretty interesting.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
And so that's going on at the United Nations. The United Nations is closed right now for Eid, but they are talking about that. Also, the president released his Medal of Freedom People today. This was started by President Kennedy 50 years ago, Tom. Gloria Steinem is, they're giving it to 16 people. We don't know the dates. Gloria Steinem is one of them.
Wow.
This is often a chance for people to recognize unsung political heroes. Sally Ride, who was a first female astronaut. Daniel Inouye. Posthumously as well as Sally Ride, Oprah Winfrey, Loretta Lynn, Bill Clinton, Ben Bradley, formerly or currently of the Washington Post, I guess, Dick Lugar, former senator, and so this is a huge deal. And again, if you look at that, a lot of those people would not have been recognized by George W. Bush.
Yeah, good point. That's one thing Barack Obama is not, is George Bush. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service. Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. You heard my rant a couple of days ago where I went off on, I mean, we're seeing these attempts at unionization for McDonald's and Burger King and whatnot, the fast food workers in New York, and now it's spreading all across the United States. People saying $7 an hour, we can't live on it. And Walmart workers going out on strike across the country saying $9 an hour, we can't live on that. And how Costco competes in the exact same area as Walmart. They sell pretty much the exact same goods for pretty much the exact same price, but they pay their workers an average wage of $22 an hour, whereas Walmart pays an average of $9 an hour. What's the difference between these two companies? Costco, the two guys who founded Costco, are not billionaires. They are merely multimillionaires. Whereas the six Walton heirs right now, just those six people, have more money than the bottom 40% of America combined. So, you know, this was my rant that basically Walmart is paying crap wages so that they can continue to funnel money to the billionaires who own them. And if the billionaires got a little less money, Walmart could do what Costco does and pay a decent wage. That's my take on it. Diane Furchtgott-Roth has a somewhat different take, and I'm curious to hear it. She's a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, contributing editor to RealClearMarkets.com. And Diana, welcome back to the program.
It's great to be with you.
Thank you. So, you know, my position is if a company can't pay or won't pay a living wage, that we should not give them all the rights and privileges that we give to business owners in this country, all the tax breaks and everything else. How do you justify Walmart handing off, you know, literally tens of billions of dollars to its owners and screwing their workers and say that's a good model compared to Costco, where the worker, you know, the owners are multimillionaires, but the workers actually get a decent wage?
Well, I would say, first of all, the law says you have to pay minimum wage, and fast food chains and Walmart follow the law. But I think the more important position is that we're looking at minimum wage workers. They are about fewer than 3% of the total workforce, and people need to get their foot on the first rung of the career ladder. So if someone has skills of around $8 an hour, if they have skills of less than $8 an hour, they can't even get in the labor force. If you raise that to $10 or $15 an hour, then you're going to have these teens and entry-level workers who aren't going to be able to get jobs. They're not going to be able to be employed. So I think that's the fundamental problem. Raising the minimum wage won't have that much effect on most people, but it'll stop low-skilled people and teens, the people who are primarily minimum wage workers, getting into the labor force and getting that first job.
Well,
I started off as a minimum wage worker.
If your concern is teens and first and entry-level workers, would you support a rise in the minimum wage, so let's say $15 an hour, which is a very low livable wage, for anybody who has been in the job market for more than 3 or 4 years?
Why stop at 15? I mean, 15 is pretty low. Why not 25 or 30, Tom?
Well, probably 15 is, I mean, 25 or 30, perhaps. I mean, if you want to calibrate it to U.S. dollars, Denmark's minimum wage right now is $22.80.
Yeah. I mean, why don't we just raise it to $22.50?
I think probably $15 is a more reasonable place to start.
But why wouldn't you raise it to $22? I mean, if $22.
Because at that point, you're actually going to start impacting business.
Well, you start impacting at $15. I mean, you're impacting at $7.25. There are people who have skills less than $7.25 who right now are not in the labor market because they can't get jobs. And you impact it every single dollar you go up.
What kind of labor is worth less than $7.25 an hour?
Well, a lot of teenagers. If you look at the African-American teen unemployment rate or the regular teen unemployment rate, the teen unemployment rate is right now 24%. The African-American teen unemployment rate is 42%. Raising the minimum wage doesn't affect many people. It affects teens and low-skilled workers, and it would make their unemployment rates rise because they would have fewer job opportunities.
There is absolutely no historical information that supports that position.
Well, there is.
In fact, to the contrary.
Studies by people such as David Newmark of the University of California. Many studies.
Please identify any one
year. Minimum wage
year.
Adversely affects low-skilled workers. It doesn't affect very many people.
Tell me any one year when we raised the minimum wage and we saw teen employment or general employment in the workforce go down. There hasn't been one.
When we raised the minimum wage and saw teen unemployment go down, right, we did not. We saw it go up.
No, I'm not saying unemployment. I'm saying employment. There has never been a year when we raised the minimum wage and you could see a consequence of that in an increase in unemployment. It's never happened.
The people who are affected by this, as I mentioned, are about 3 or 4 million people in a labor force of about 156 million.
Well, let me be very clear then. I'm not just talking about people making $7.25 an hour. I'm talking about people making under $10 an hour. And as you know, that's probably closer to 30-35% of the labor force in the United States.
It's lower than 35% of the labor force, but there's no point in arguing about numbers. Basically, already, employers in the United States are paying higher than minimum wage to 97% of their employed workers, not because they're kind, but because that's what they have to do to retain their employees.
Yes. So back to Walmart and Costco. Isn't there a point where we say billionaires accumulating tens of billions of dollars, or even hundreds of billions of dollars? I don't know how much the six Walmart heirs in aggregate. If they were one person, if Sam Walton was still around, he'd be the richest person on earth. Isn't there a point where you say enough already? And before the Reagan tax cuts, people didn't accumulate that kind of wealth. Sam Walton didn't accumulate that kind of wealth.
But wages aren't set by how much the owners of a company earn, because otherwise you'd have, I don't know, say the owners of a company such as maybe McDonald's or Burger King, maybe they are making a lot, so they should pay their workers more than employees at Joe's Diner. But then that doesn't make sense, because then the burgers at McDonald's wouldn't be competitive with the burgers at Joe's Diner.
But if what you're suggesting is right,
productivity, and also you have companies that are not profit making, you have companies that are operating at a loss that need to pay their employees a lot more because maybe they're high-tech companies such as Amazon.com, which didn't make a profit for very many years, but it still needed to pay people a lot in order to retain them.
Well, that's what you get investment money from. But if your position is correct, that wages to workers are completely decoupled from the amount of money that people at the top can suck out of the company,
correct,
then why is it that the wages, that the amount of money that the people at the top were sucking out of the company in the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, and up until the mid-80s, was fairly constant at about 30 times what an average worker made? And once Ronald Reagan said, if you're at the very top, we're going to take that 74% top tax rate and drop it down to 28%. You can suck all the money out you want. And at that point, we saw an explosion in the income of the top 1%, 275% now since Reagan's presidency. We saw a bigger explosion in the top 0.1% and the 0.01% is thousands of percent greater, and we saw no increase in wages.
Yeah, well, that's because you're right that starting from 1986, the Tax Reform Act of 1986, that made it more profitable for companies to file on the individual tax code. So there are a lot of corporations that before would file as corporations. They switched to filing as individuals because the top tax rate was 28%. So what it seemed as though was that there was a lot more income on the individual earning scale. So that's why data from pre-1986 are not comparable with post-1986.
So you're saying it's a mirage. The rich actually aren't getting wildly richer and the poor actually aren't getting screwed?
I'm saying that comparing pre-1986 data and post-1986 data are not correct.
Okay.
And in fact, if you're talking about inequality getting greater, these numbers are very, very complicated because the top income earners pay a very high share of tax. The top 1% pay 37% of taxes. Top 5% pay 60% of all taxes.
Okay, Diana Furchgott-Roth from the Manhattan Institute. Thank you, Diana.
Thanks very much. Bye.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be back with Geeky Science Rocks and your calls right after this. Hey, it's Thursday. Let's get geeky with Geeky Science. A minute or two every week where I can kind of wander off into one of my favorite fields. You know, there's already plenty of information out there to make anybody think twice about smoking. Most people cringe at the thought that, or the knowledge, that a single cigarette contains 69 primary chemicals known to cause cancer. And most people are stunned when they hear that smoking is the cause of 1 in 5 deaths every day, every year in the United States. But for those who remain skeptical and aren't convinced by this huge body of research about smoking causing cancer, heart attacks, and strokes, there's a new study out, and it's a stunner. A team of scientists and researchers from the Harbor UCLA Medical Center has discovered that when mother smokes, asthma shows up in their great-grandchildren, the third generation, great-grandchildren who may not even know mother, have never seen her. Previous studies have shown an association between nicotine exposure or tobacco exposure and asthma, but this is a whole new thing. Scientists discovered that the cause of future generations' asthma was something called epigenetic modification. It happens when a poison is so bad that it even damages DNA. Virendra K. Rehan, the lead researcher on the study, told Science Daily that, quote, Even though there are multiple causes for childhood asthma, research linking this serious chronic condition to maternal nicotine exposure during pregnancy for up to three generations should give mothers-to-be even more reasons to reconsider smoking. Right now, 250 million women around the world smoke. And here in the U.S., 12% of women continue to smoke during pregnancy, resulting in the birth of over 400,000 smoke-exposed babies every year in our country alone. There are plenty of reasons not to smoke, but this new research should make anyone, especially mothers-to-be, think twice about that deadly addiction. Whew, that is pretty amazing. Okay, Khalil in Dublin, Virginia. Hey, Khalil, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Tom.
Yes,
you
sir.
There?
I am.
Oh, awesome. Look, what if this was an experiment, these people who dream up these crazy ideas, tobacco, smoking, well, I'm not going to say tobacco, but let's just say the smoking of this device that they've given us, and they create these wars and do all these other crazy things. What if they were an experiment, they take control over our lives economically, and what if this was an experiment gone awry thousands of years ago, and they were created this mind, discovered that through brain waves they could occupy space and time seconds before the event occurs, and yet it's been withheld from us. But they created this species of creature called what we define as human being today, and they actually were used to protect us, designed to protect us. And they went awry. They got so powerful, their thoughts, that so to speak. They gain power over our lives.
I think you have the basis of a science fiction story here, Khalil.
We create it.
I think you've got the basis of a science fiction story. Have you seen Matt Damon's got a new movie coming out, Ephelion Fields or something like that, which is, you know, all the right-wingers are all hysterical about. Khalil, thank you for the call, because they're saying that it's actually tonight at 10 o'clock here in D.C. There's the first plane of it, and then it opens tomorrow nationwide. There's an interesting review of it in today's New York Times. How do you say it, Shano? Elysium. Oh, yeah, as in Elysian Fields. And the movie takes place in 2154, as I recall, in, you know, 100-some-odd years in the future, where just the world has been destroyed. And just like John Galt, the billionaires went on strike, and they took themselves away from the planet, and they built a space station, and they kind of live up there. And so life is really great there, not so great here, or some variation of this. Now, I haven't seen the movie. I will report back when I have. But what I find really interesting is the Drudge headlines today, which we're talking about, you know, new Damon film, Socialism on Steroids. Right, because it talks about the difference between the rich and the poor. So it must be socialism, right? Yeah. Corey in Auburn, Washington. Hey, Corey, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom. Yeah, I was calling about like the minimum wage versus a maximum wage.
Mm-hmm.
Now, some of our maximum, I mean, our wages today, like $1 to $1.5 million an hour, those are just so pretentious. You know, to think that somebody's actually doing anything to actually earn that.
Yeah.
I was thinking like with trickle down economics, what has happened is we've separated the productivity of people from wages. You know, the productivity all now goes to the shareholders and the bosses, and the wages are pretty much stagnated. If you look back at 1980, where the top 1% made half as much as the bottom 50% of the people. By 2006, the top 1% made three times as much as the bottom 50% of the people. So I was thinking, you know, it's like all they're doing is if you have like a picture of a coffee cup filling up full of money.
Yeah.
And they just keep building the sides higher and higher and higher to hold a lot of money with a little spigot trickling down the bottom. I mean, if we limited that, the height of that cup, you know, and let it overflow the top, you know, we get a lot more trickle going and a lot more people, you know. I mean, it seemed like the United States were really good at creating.
Well, let's just blow up the trickle-down metaphor altogether. Economies grow from the bottom up, not from the top down. The only reason anybody sells anything is because somebody else wants to buy it, not simply because it exists.
And trickle-down economics, the other term for that was the supply-side economics.
Right.
So it's not a free market. They supply us. They always supply us, you know,
Right. And the argument that they make is, you know, Steve Jobs invented the iPhone and now everybody wants one and now everybody else is going to make some. Yeah, there are a lot of inventions that are game changers, but they don't drive an entire economy. What they do is they drive sectors. They drive individual niches, wedges. You know, the invention of radio, the invention of television. Those things had a stimulative effect on the economy. But it wasn't because the companies said, here you go. I mean, if the companies had said, here you go, but the price is $100,000 forever on a television, nobody ever would have bought one. It's because, here you go, and by the way, if you're a working person, you can actually afford to have one of these things. So it requires both supply and demand. And this is the thing that you correctly point out, Corey, the supply-siders, the trickle-downers, you know, what was the old thing? They're turning us into a nation of peons and telling us that it's raining, right? This doesn't work. Anyhow, Corey, thank you. Thank you. Oh, well said. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And Corey, thanks for listening to WBCS or KBCS there in Seattle. We'll be right back. The good, the bad, and the very, very long, caudally ugly, the good. Sanjay Gupta. On Wednesday night's episode, Piers Morgan Live, CNN's chief medical correspondent, spoke the truth about marijuana in America and apologized for his previous opposition to medical use. Take a look.
You changed your mind.
I have, and as part of my thinking reason, I've apologized for some of the earlier reporting because I think, you know, we've been terribly and systematically misled in this country for some time, and I did part of that misleading. You know, if you look at all the papers that are written in the United States about marijuana, the vast majority of them are about the harm. That we fund studies on harm, we don't fund studies on benefit nearly as much. So it gives a distorted picture. But, you know, I didn't look far enough. I didn't look deep enough. I didn't look at labs in other countries that are doing some incredible research. I didn't listen to the chorus of patients who said, not only does marijuana work for me, it's the only thing that works for me. I took the DEA at their word when they said it's a Schedule I substance and has no medical applications. There was no scientific basis for them to say that.
Took the DEA at their word? Dr. Gupta is absolutely correct and should be commended for his honesty. It's just too bad he passed on the chance to work as Surgeon General for the Obama administration. But you know what they say, the grass is always greener on the other side. The bad, Mike Huckabee, the former Arkansas governor, went on what was, by all accounts, an extremely Islamophobic rant during a Monday night broadcast of his radio show. Take a listen.
If you've kept up with the Middle East, you know that the most likely time to have an uprising of rock throwing and rioting comes on the day of prayer on Friday. So the Muslims will go to the mosque and they will have their day of prayer and they come out of there like uncorked animals, throwing rocks and burning cars.
Just despicable. If Governor Huckabee paid any attention at all to events right here in the United States, he'd notice that white Christian Americans act like uncorked animals and riot all the time when their favorite sports team wins a championship. The truth is that bad behavior knows no religious boundary. And the very, very ugly Arizona protesters. On Tuesday, President Obama arrived in Phoenix to unveil his administration's new housing policy. Presidential speech is always an occasion for protests. So the fact that hundreds of people stood outside the high school where he was speaking isn't all that notable. What is notable, though, is what they were saying. As reported on by Talking Points Memo, groups of right-wing radical protesters chanted racial epithets at the president. One protester even demanded that Congress impeach the half-white Muslim. The president is clearly not a Muslim, not that that matters anyway, and the fact that anyone, no matter how much they dislike his policies, is still using discredited, bigoted theories to attack him, that is just very, very ugly. It's incredibly ugly. I have to just share this one short thing with you. This is posted over on the Daily Kos, but props to WLOS-TV down in North Carolina. This is in Swannanoa, North Carolina. Kimberly King reporting for the local TV station, Channel 13. And Congressman McHenry, Patrick McHenry, the Republican from North Carolina, teabagger from North Carolina, is doing a town hall meeting. And she's interviewing a mother outside this town hall meeting before it starts. Here's a little clip of that interview.
Thanks, Tammy. We are live, and people are already starting to gather for this town hall meeting. I'm joined right now by Leslie Boyd. And, Leslie, you have a story about your son, Mike, who passed away from colon cancer, and you feel that if Obamacare had been passed earlier and that Republicans had not tried to stonewall it, your son might have survived. So maybe just tell us a little bit about why you feel that way.
Well, my son had a pre-existing condition, a birth defect. And without that birth defect, he probably would have been able to get insurance. But that birth defect prevented him from getting insurance, and without it, he could not get the care he needed. And so he got colon cancer, and they caught it after it had already spread, so he died. Under Obamacare.
Now, you all actually had a coffee talk meeting earlier today. I guess it was a lead up to the town hall meeting tonight. There were other stories that were shared as well also, right?
Yes, there were several. We had someone who had breast cancer and was unable to get insurance. We had a man who had a vascular brain condition that needed surgery that he almost died before he was able to get the surgery because he didn't have insurance. So without Obamacare, as it's called, 70% of people with pre-existing conditions can't get insurance. 70%. That's terrible, because what that does is say you can die.
Well, we will. It'll certainly be a very interesting town hall meeting.
There we go. So, props to the reporter. I mean, you know, I'm sure conservatives are going, "Oh, it's liberal media. How dare they interview a mother?" But here's Representative Patrick McHenry, Republican from North Carolina, one of the few Republicans who's actually holding town hall meetings and meeting with his constituents, goes ahead and meets with his constituents, and some guy stands up and says, "Why do you keep voting to defund Obamacare when it's going to save us billions and billions of dollars?" And after he says this, the crowd just starts going nuts, applauding. And then you got to hear this crowd response to McHenry. You may not even be able to hear what he says because it's pretty bad audio. But the crowd response is just 10 seconds of audio here. Just listen to this.
Thank you for the question. And
actually, let me back it up just a little bit. This is
Republican Party. To answer the question is, why do I not have a moral right and access to health care, and you want to defund Obamacare, which is by law and policy going to save billions of dollars over the next 10 years?
So why do you want to defund Obamacare, which is going to save billions of dollars over the next 10 years? That's fair. And here's McHenry's response.
Thank you for the question.
This guy's kind of rambling on a little bit more. And he gets another applause, the questioner. And then McHenry finally gets a chance to speak, and he says,
So the high-risk pool qualified under was not created by Obamacare. It was created by the state legislature. Okay?
He's trying to pitch his high-risk pool.
That I think what
says, that's a better solution than Obamacare. You heard it. I mean, this is very interesting. Now, in other town hall meetings, Republicans are hearing from Tea Partiers who are showing up going, "Why didn't you defund Obamacare? I want my health insurance taken away." By the way, where do I cash this check from FreedomWorks? Anyhow. Leon in Heathville, Virginia. Hey, Leon, what's up?
Your last guest, Diana Roth, she's a fine example of that old cliche. There are lies, damn lies, and statistics, and she really fulfills it.
Well, let's not pick on her. She's not here to defend herself, and I have to take her at her word. I think that she believes what she's saying.
Well,
I disagree with it, but
yeah.
You know, rather than picking on her, let's talk about the statistics and the information. Do you have a comment on that?
Well, the average minimum wage, if it kept pace with the productivity, should be $22 an hour.
Right. As Elizabeth Warren pointed out, yes, if the minimum wage since the Reagan presidency had followed productivity like it did all the way up to the Reagan presidency, the minimum wage right now would be $22 an hour.
And another thing, I would like to see you, Bernie, and Matt all get together and form an organization where we could have kind of a citizen's manifesto about the single issues. And I think we could even bring some Tea Party in on that.
Yeah, I think so. They might get in on the privacy stuff and on the smoking dope stuff. And if a liberal ever decided to campaign on legalizing prostitution, you'd have the libertarians on that, too. That's their other big thing. Leon, thanks a lot for the call. James in Fresno, California. Hey, James.
Hey, Tom. How's it going?
Good. What's up?
I don't want to pick on Mrs. Roth either, but it kind of irks me how, you know, this mindset of devaluing these entry-level positions that people work in as if they're just nothing but teenagers that provide no skills or attribute to the company, when in fact,
right,
you need those people in those entry-level positions. It's one of the reasons why Costco is so successful and people enjoy working there,
mm-hmm,
because they understand that, you know, these are the people that are out there every day.
Yeah.
You know,
these are the people who are making the owners rich.
Exactly. And you know, these are the people that might work up to the company and understand it better. But, I mean, just devaluing these entry-level positions is wrong. It's one of the reasons why these McDonald's workers and these Walmart workers are on strike, because they feel they're more valuable to that.
Yeah. Yeah, I you're absolutely right. James, thank you for the call, and thanks for, you know, making an excellent point. Emily in Nashville, Tennessee. Hey, Emily, what's up?
Yes, I wanted to make a comment on Ms. Roth's comment, too. I've worked most of my life. I'm in my late 50s, and oftentimes...
Emily, I'm going to put you on hold here. My sincere apologies. I missed the time cue, and I didn't realize we only had 10 seconds to the break. Let me put you on hold. We'll pick your call up on the other side of the break, okay? Hold on just a second. We'll be back to you, Emily. It is 15 minutes before the hour here on the Tom Hartman program. And shouldn't it be a simple policy of the United States? Hang on.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
But if you're going to do business in this country and take all the tax breaks and limitations of liability associated with it, that you have to pay a reasonable wage. Occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week, right here on the Tom Hartman program. Elizabeth in Farming Hills, Michigan. Or is that Farmington Hills?
Yeah, Farmington Hills. Hi, Tom. I had been listening when you were talking with Miss Roth, mm-hmm, and I won't go after her, but I will suggest that anybody who was around in the late 60s, early 70s, saw a breadwinner at work and his partner or her partner at home.
Yeah.
And if we raise the minimum wage to $22 or $23 an hour right now, half of the partners and families that are raising children could stay home.
Yep.
They would actually be able to raise their children again like we used to and not keep contributing to all of the problem areas that have cropped up in the last 30 years, the prison industrial complex, the problem with the cost of going to college, the problems with employment in various areas of the country, trying to employ enough people that their states can actually function. If we raise that minimum wage, it would give us all a chance to relax a minute, settle back, raise our children, and pay attention to what the government's up to.
I agree. Yeah. And in fact, when she said, well, why not just raise it to $22, I regret not having said, yeah, that's a great idea, because I had forgotten, frankly, sometimes in the middle of these things, you just don't have every statistic at the top of your head. I had forgotten that $22 an hour is what the minimum wage would be right now if it had kept track with productivity since the Reagan presidency. But the two got decoupled by Reagan, and minimum wage flattened out, and productivity continued to rise. And of course, all the profit from that productivity went to the Walton family. You know, so excellent point, Elizabeth. Thank you for calling and making it. Dwayne in Petaluma, California. Hey, Dwayne, what's up?
Oh, thank you. And yes, back when I went to school, you can actually make a minimum wage $2.50 and pay for your college.
Yeah.
$2.50 an hour. But on your, I love your science information.
Thank you.
And your comments on smoking basically points to smoking as a grandchild abuse. And I just don't see us as being other than enablees, the fact that we haven't raised the smoking age to 21.
Yeah.
And in addition to that, you just pointed out that the smoking, one-fifth of deaths result from that, I assume one-fifth of medical costs. If we put the correct tax on smoking, not only would we have far fewer people doing it, we'd have far smaller medical costs. And that just seems fair that we take that money and put it to help pay for a single payer.
Yeah, and I'm guessing it's actually more than one-fifth of all medical costs because, A, you've got a lot of diseases that are associated with smoking that are long-term chronic, you know, lung disease, heart disease, strokes, things like that. Two, people who do die of cancer, you know, which is only one of several ways people die from smoking, it's prolonged and expensive, whereas there's a lot of people in the United States who die in accidents, 50,000 people a year in car accidents, for example, people who die of drug overdoses. Those are relatively instantaneous, so those are not expensive deaths. And so, therefore, I would submit to you that while smoking accounts for one out of five deaths or one-fifth of deaths, it probably accounts for more like a quarter of all, maybe even a half of all medical expenses, or maybe 30, 35%, something like that. I'd have to look at the numbers. But, Dwayne, excellent point. Thank you for calling and making it. Claude in Oceanside, New York. Hey, Claude, what's up?
Hey, Tom. During this talk with Ms. Roth, you know, you let her at the end actually support your position, but you didn't accept it. You had said that under Reagan, the big trader, you know, they changed income rate from the super wealthy from 74% down to 28%.
Right.
And then she said yes, and she literally went on to explain which act and which bill in Congress changed them to allow them to use the individual tax
yep.
rate rather than the corporate tax rate, which did not do anything to buttress to opposition what your position was.
I know. Well, no, actually what she said then was, and then it gets very, very complicated, and I think the message essentially was just leave it to the experts and don't raise the minimum wage. We know what we're talking about. You guys don't. And I thought about responding with a kind of snarky thing, but I thought, that's beneath me. So, but Claude, you're right. I think that she did validate my argument, and I thank her for doing that. Claude, thanks for the call. Donald in Aurora, Illinois. Hey, Donald.
Yes, hi, Tom. I heard that story that you were talking about what they did to President Obama. You know, I was watching on the news too about the health care that he wants to produce or project. And the thing is, in North Carolina, they're creating cards and burning them, pretending you know like that to show that they're how unfavorable they are with the. With the health care.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, these Obamacare cards. This is Dick Armey's FreedomWorks new thing.
Right.
They're printing up Obamacare cards so that you can burn them like a draft card.
These are the governors that are causing this. You know what really is killing me and getting me really angry is where is the outrage from the Democratic Party and the Democratic voters? And, you know,
I think they're going to show up in 2014, Donald.
Oh, we're going to lose 2014 as far as I'm concerned.
I don't think so. I think that people are organizing. People are getting ready. I'm actually quite optimistic about it. Well, we'll see. We'll see. You know, Donald, we should have a conversation, the day after the elections in November, a year and a half from now. I'm sure we'll talk many times between now and then, but I look forward to that conversation. Warren in La Quinta, California. I'm sorry. That's off topic. Mike in Aurora, Colorado. You wanted a final comment on Diana Roth? We just have a minute. It's all yours.
Yes, Mr. Herman. I just want to say, I am no economist, nor am I college educated, but one of the things that I heard her say that I just don't understand at all is she was saying that if you raise the minimum wage, that more teens and low-skilled workers would have less employment. The unemployment rate for those individuals would go up due to the fact that their skill level isn't as valuable as those wages. How does that make sense to me? Because you're talking about, you know, let's say you're a McDonald's worker. If you raise the wage of that job, does that create a harder skill for that position? To me, that would just say that the wages is
is hired for that position.
Yeah.
Raising the skill level for that.
She's describing situations in a country with full employment and a strong middle class, which is basically where we were back in the 60s, you know, with unemployment of 4.5%, 5%. And that's not the way America is right now. So, you know, I could see in a situation where you had full employment and a strong middle class having an entry-level wage for teenagers, like, you know, the job I got when I was 14, 15 years old, flipping burgers. But, you know, the rest of it, no, not so much. Anyhow, democracy begins with you tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.